to appear like a ghost.
Reports of what appeared to be federal immigration agents using cars without rear license plates, which are required in all states.
We'll talk about what our reporting has found this Tuesday, October 28th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump is set to meet Chinese leader Xi Jinping this week in South Korea.
What's at stake for the two countries?
I think we're going to end up having a fantastic deal with China. It's going to be a great trade deal. It's going to be fantastic for both countries.
In Japan, gender inequality is pushing women out of rural areas and into cities.
And that flight is further pulling down the country's low birth rate.
Policymakers haven't faced the fact that women have their own choices to make. We feel like we're seen as baby-making machines.
Those stories and more are coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. A federal judge in San Francisco has indefinitely halted many of the Trump administration's mass layoffs tied to the government shutdown. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the decision pauses, for now, the layoffs of thousands of federal employees.
U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston sided with a group of federal employee unions. She found they're likely to show that actions taken by the Trump administration since October 1st to fire thousands of federal workers are illegal. In court, the attorney for the government pushed back, arguing that the executive branch has the authority to conduct layoffs before, during, and after a shutdown, and that it's good policy to end programs that don't align with the president's priorities. The union's attorney called the government's arguments absurd and asserted that a lapse in appropriations does not justify permanently eliminating positions. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
A separate lawsuit is seeking to force the Trump administration to fund the SNAP Food Assistance Program. A group of Democratic attorneys general and governors filed the suit today in federal court in Massachusetts, saying the administration is legally required to keep SNAP going using money from a contingency fund. Vice President J.D. Vance says members of the military will not miss their next paycheck on Friday as the government shutdown continues. Vance met for lunch on Capitol Hill with Senate Republicans who have been weighing temporary funding for U.S. troops and other essential workers. Here's NPR's Sam Greenglass.
Vance and other Trump administration officials have warned that repurposing funds to keep the troops paid may not be sustainable into November.
We do think that we can continue paying the troops, at least for now. We've got food stamp benefits that are set to run out in a week. We're trying to keep as much open as possible. We just need the Democrats to actually help us out a little bit.
The Senate was considering measures to temporarily keep paychecks flowing to troops and air traffic controllers. But now top Republicans say they're not interested in what they call rifle shot bills. A GOP bill to fund SNAP benefits is unlikely to get a vote this week either. Vance says the way to stop the pain is to reopen the government. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
Hurricane Melissa made landfall today as Jamaica's strongest hurricane on record. Melissa has lost a bit of strength, but remains a powerful Category 4 hurricane, crossing over western Jamaica with top winds of 150 miles per hour. NPR's Ader Peralta is keeping track of the storm.
The National Hurricane Center says we should expect catastrophic damage in Jamaica. I mean, you know, these winds are just incredibly strong. The only sort of good news that we have is that it will glance Kingston, Jamaica, which is the biggest city in the country. But, you know, the whole western part of Jamaica is going to be in the eye of this storm, and we should expect just massive amounts of damage.
And you're listening to NPR News. Israeli warplanes struck Gaza today after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the military to carry out what he called powerful attacks. An Israeli military official told NPR that Netanyahu ordered the strikes after Hamas carried out an attack against Israeli soldiers in an area under Israeli control. Israel is also accusing Hamas of slow-walking the handover remains of Israeli hostages. The ceasefire began on October 10th. Each side has accused the other of violations. Los Angeles Dodgers and Toronto Blue Jays are set to resume Major League Baseball's World Series after last night's marathon game that lasted a record-tying 18 innings. L.A. won the game and leads the series 2-1. Here's reporter Steve Futterman.
Like so many times during this World Series, the pregame focus is on the Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani. Up until now, Ohtani has been simply hitting. Tonight, for the first time in his career, Ohtani will pitch in the World Series. In last night's 18-inning game, Ohtani got on base a World Series record 9 times. He had 2 home runs, a pair of doubles, and 5 walks. L.A. manager Dave Roberts acknowledges Ohtani is tired.
He's spent. I mean, he was on base 8-9 times, running the bases. But yeah, he'll be ready.
His 2 home runs last night was the 3rd time this postseason that Ohtani has had a multi-homer game. No one has ever done that in a single year. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the World Series in Los Angeles.
Another day of record highs on Wall Street. All 3 U.S. stock markets pushed into record territory. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It is 4:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Cloudy tonight, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 47 to 51. Itasca County Family YMCA has their annual fall auction and social this Saturday, 5:30 at Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids. Find more details and view the auction at ymcaitasca.org. At 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Right now, more from All Things Considered.
Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. By now, some of the Trump administration's immigration tactics are well known. Swarming federal agents, in some cases detaining people by force or breaking down doors. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers seen wearing masks over their faces. But far less public attention has been paid to the apparent masking of the vehicles that these agents are using. NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo has been looking into this and joins us now. Hey, Jimena.
Hi, Elsa.
So what have you learned?
Over the course of the last few months, NPR investigative reporter Kiara Eisner and I have seen several videos on social media of federal officers conducting what appear to be immigration arrests. And we noticed that some of the videos shot in states like California and Illinois, vehicles appear to be driven by federal agents, but they don't have rear license plates, which are required in all states.
Exactly.
Since the start of this administration, there have been questions regarding how ICE as an agency should be operating and whether they can or should be concealing their personal identities, vehicles, or uniforms. And we spoke with several immigration advocates who say they had seen arrests made using vehicles without license plates.
Wait, but does ICE have any official regulations about this practice of hiding or not having back license plates?
Mm-hmm. ICE spokesperson Mike Alvarez told me that federal law allows government vehicles to be exempt from displaying government plates if that would interfere with their, quote, critical duties. DHS officials have previously said that their officers are seeing outsized doxing and interference with arrests, but former agency employees still see this tactic as unusual. I spoke with Darius Reeves, who was a former field office director for the ICE enforcement and removal operations in Baltimore until earlier this year.
The agency clearly wants to appear like a ghost, that there's no way that the vehicles can be, you know, tracked back to a particular field office.
ICE's policy manual says the exemptions have to be requested internally, but the agency declined to confirm how many exemptions have been requested this year. And while ICE has been the agency to get all this attention, we can't be sure yet that ICE is the one operating without license plates. The Trump administration is mixing and matching federal law enforcement agencies, bringing on people from the Department of Justice, IRS, and others to do immigration enforcement. And each has different policies and rules for how they can operate.
Okay. Well, Jimena, explain why it could be important for the public to have information like license plates.
Some advocates say that people might have different rights depending on who's making the arrest. Bruno Huizar from the California Immigrant Policy Center, an immigrant rights organization, said most people are just not used to interacting with federal law enforcement.
So people are more on high alert that federal law enforcement with their vehicles are on the streets and, you know, can protect themselves, as opposed to not knowing who this agency is and not knowing what their rights are in that circumstance.
David Beer at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, said if someone can't find identifiable information, such as a license plate, it can make it difficult to file subpoenas or other legal actions.
If you don't know the vehicle's ID information, then, you know, good luck finding the driver, good luck finding you know, other information.
And he said that the lack of identification could result in people resisting arrests and less cooperation.
Well, going forward, do you think this tactic of obscuring license plates will continue during this administration?
Well, remember that the administration wants to hire 10,000 more deportation officers by the end of the year. And advocates warn that as more people get hired and the administration continues a fast pace of arrests, there will be more and more encounters between the public and federal law enforcement. So it's possible that we see different and more attempts to mask identities. And if it's not clear exactly who people are and what agency this is and what they should be doing, it could sow mistrust and fear.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
Today, Amazon announced that it will be laying off 14,000 employees. That is about 4% of its workforce. The company says it's part of a larger effort to reduce costs while investing in artificial intelligence. Amazon's move today is part of a broader trend across industries. Companies are betting that they can slow down hiring and maximize profits at the same time. Chip Cutter is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's been keeping an eye on all of this and joins us now. But a note before we begin that Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. Hi, Chip.
Hi there.
Chip, so let's just get into it and start with the news from Amazon today. What can you tell us about their decision to make these cuts?
Well, this is one of many cuts Amazon has made in recent years. And the CEO, Andy Jassy, has made clear that he wants the company to slim down. He wants to cut costs. He wants to find efficiencies. And what this means is more job cuts. This is a company that is looking to lean in to artificial intelligence, like so many, and it thinks there's ways to sort of essentially do more with less here. It was interesting. You had one of the company's executives telling employees today in a note that the company would get even stronger, according to her note, by reducing bureaucracy and removing layers, shifting resources. This is what you hear a lot of companies say right now, which is they think they actually can keep doing this, can keep their business growing even with fewer people.
I mean, this is not just Amazon. You've written that many large companies across a whole lot of industries are doing this. They're cutting jobs. They're reluctant to hire, yet they're still pushing for increased profits and sales. Tell us about how some of these companies are explaining this strategic decision.
Absolutely. It's really a gamble of the moment to say, can you do this? Can you keep your company humming along, boosting sales, juicing profits, all of that without adding people? And a lot of companies think they can do it. And so it's interesting. You have, you know, JP Morgan Chase's CFO recently told investors that the bank had a, quote, very strong bias against having the response to hire more people for any given need. You've seen companies like Goldman Sachs say they want to constrain headcount through the end of this year and reduce roles that could be more efficient with AI. And I think it's also really interesting just to see what Walmart is doing. Mm. Walmart is the nation's largest private employer, and it has said it wants to keep its headcount roughly flat over the next 3 years, even as its sales grow. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon was at an event last month where he said it's very clear that AI is going to change literally every job. And I think that's how many executives think right now. They think that AI is going to change so much, and many think that they just will not need to hire as many roles, or that they can keep their headcounts flat to reflect this new reality.
So if we set profits aside for a moment, does artificial intelligence and its unpredictability create a logistical problem? I mean, how can companies predict and plan for hiring if the technology is so rapidly changing?
It's really difficult. I mean, it's a number of HR chiefs have told me that they really can't even think a year out how many roles they might need or what the size of the company should be because this is changing so quickly. And so companies have cut the number of layers, they've cut the number of people. It means people are having to, in some cases, take on the jobs of multiple employees. They're not being promoted. They feel sort of stuck in place. That's made it all harder. And I think it's also worth noting that some of these tools still have some of their issues, that some of these coding assistants and some of these Gen AI tools that people are using still don't always produce great work. There's a reason some people call it work slop, that it's just not always totally reliable. And so I think executives are banking on this. They're spending millions to sort of pump AI into their companies. But I think we'll see sort of how this all goes.
I mean, we've talked a lot about this from the perspective of executives and companies, but I'm just thinking if I'm listening to this and I'm a worker who's out there looking for a job, or if I'm an employee with an existing job and trying to keep my job, what kind of impact could this trend have on those people?
Well, for one, I think it makes it a lot more difficult for existing employees. You may be sort of expected to do more with fewer people around you to help. Of course, some of these tech tools could make things easier, could reduce some of the sort of drudgery that you have to do throughout the day.
But I also think if you're someone who's out of work right now, things have become really difficult. This is a tricky labor market to navigate because a number of the biggest, most prominent employers in the U.S. are now slowing their hiring. Some have said they just essentially don't want to hire right now. And so it can be really tough for people to figure out how they're going to get another new job and what that might look like. And so I just think this is sort of a complicated moment, both for existing employees and for those who are trying to find their next job.
Chip Cutter is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, where he covers the workplace management and leadership issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
50 million dollars. That's how much a new fund is dedicating to literary arts over the next 5 years. And as NPR's Andrew Limbong reports, the money is coming at a pretty crucial time.
Right now, small independent presses, writers' residency programs, book festivals, and more all across the country are looking at some gaps in their budgets. Many of them count on federal support, and the Trump administration's cuts to federal arts and humanities programs have a lot of that funding stuck in legal limbo. Enter the Literary Arts Fund.
Across all of our culture and humanities funding, the cuts have been very significant, and we've been thinking about different ways to address them. But this fund was well underway long before those cuts happened.
That's Elizabeth Alexander, writer, poet, and president of the Mellon Foundation, which started the grant program in collaboration with six other charitable foundations, including, by the way, the MacArthur Foundation, which provides financial support to NPR. Anyway, Alexander says the goal of this fund is to offer something big enough that nonprofit literary arts programs can think long-term about their futures, something that can withstand the ups and downs of federal spending on the arts, and to foster a literary culture that can exist outside of what shows up on the bestsellers lists.
I know that artists will always make art. I know that you cannot extinguish that flame. I know that absolutely. But at the same time, what I would hate to see is an economy where only the very most commercial would be the ones who were readily available to us.
According to a study done by the Literary Arts Fund, in 2023, literary arts programs received less than 2% of the $5 billion given out in grant money to arts programs. Alexander says a lot of that is because we take literature for granted. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXC. It is 4:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Chance of rain tonight, lows 32 to 40, and tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 47 to 51.
On today's date, October 28th in the year 2002, as I was driving around on my mail route, I couldn't help but notice that the white popple were starting to lose their leaves. Now, most of us looking at this plant would identify it as a member of the maple family because it has a sort of a three-lobed leaf. But it is, in fact, white popple. And if you look at the leaves, especially late in October like this, you're going to see on one side of the leaf, it's going to have the appearance of a cup of cocoa, kind of a nice cocoa-y brown. On the other side of the leaf, you're going to see a pure white layer. And that white layer is what gives this tree its common name, white popple. So when you see these trees late in the fall, and you see those maple-like leaves, chocolate on one side, white on the other. Remember, not a maple, white popple.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Japan has more elderly adults than any major nation, and it is losing nearly a million people a year. By mid-century, an estimated 750 towns and villages may vanish from the map. One of the surest indicators of a village's slide toward extinction is when young women start leaving. NPR's Anthony Kuhn explains.
Crowds cheer as young men balance bamboo poles up to 40 feet high with lanterns on their hands, heads, hips, and shoulders. It's a centuries-old tradition unique to Japan's Akita Prefecture. Only men are allowed to touch the poles and be sashite, or pole carriers. The women play flutes and drums. One pole carrier is New Zealand college student Roz Tripp. He says Kanto is rooted in Japan's Shinto religion.
The reason only men can be sashite is because the goddess resides in the pole and she doesn't like being touched by women. She gets jealous.
Miwa Sawano is a college senior and former Kanto Club member. She accepts Kanto's gender roles as part of Akita's traditional culture, but she objects to the club's drinking parties with local residents.
Things like sexual harassment happen. Kanto performers wear shorts and girls' legs get touched a lot by the local men.
Akita has the most aged population, the lowest birth rate, and the fastest rate of population decline of Japan's 47 prefectures. A government report in June said that many women are leaving rural areas due to rigid gender roles there. Even more leave for better jobs, but Chuo University sociologist Masahiro Yamada says there's a gender angle to that too.
Middle-aged and older men in rural areas don't want to change the current situation of discrimination against women, where women are stuck in temporary or part-time jobs and only men get promoted. Women don't want to work in these places, so they move to Tokyo.
But some women stay in or return to their hometowns to try to improve them. I met one such person in Nirasaki, a small city of about 28,000 people, some 80 miles west of Tokyo in Yamanashi Prefecture.
So it's about 1 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon, and this is the main street of Nirasaki. And there's a fair amount of traffic, but most of the storefronts and shops here are shuttered.
26-year-old Ren Yamamoto wanted to make young rural women's voices heard. She taped 100 interviews and posted them on YouTube.
Lots of them said that when they go back to their hometowns, they feel pressure because they're asked, when are you getting married? When are you going to have children? And they're sick of being forced into such a role.
Yamamoto put the issue of gender inequality and depopulation on the map. Public broadcaster NHK reported on her project. Later, then-Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba invited her to meet with him. Yamamoto told Ishiba that government policies are missing the mark.
Policies to support women have been centered on childcare and marriage, without addressing the reasons why women leave rural areas. Policymakers haven't faced the fact that women have their own choices to make. We feel like we're seen as baby-making machines.
Japanese women's political empowerment ranks 125th out of 148 countries in the World Economic Forum's Gender Gap Report for 2025. Back in Akita, kids try drumming as the Kanto performance wraps up. Many women are pessimistic about changing Akita's conservative traditional culture. Independent Akita journalist Miwako Miura says her local newspaper boss told her not to report on gender inequality.
The deeper you go into rural areas, the more people try to not talk about gender issues. People are afraid that if they say something that crosses the line, they'll be criticized. It's a taboo.
Some rural women complain of what they call in Japanese, moya moya. It's a vague feeling that something is wrong, but you can't quite put your finger on it. Often, it's enough to make women leave the countryside. College senior Miwa Sawano says, let them go.
Let Akita be depopulated. There is no way of stopping it, honestly speaking. They won't realize they have a problem until the women leave.
Sawano adds that women should not have to suffer oppression in the name of preserving traditional culture. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Akita, Japan.
President Trump is set to meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping later this week. The meeting comes amid growing tensions over trade between the U.S. and China. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivram is traveling with Trump in Asia and brings us this report.
Trump's whirlwind Asia trip has included stops in Malaysia and Japan. The president next heads to Korea ahead of the APEC summit there. But really the focus is on just one meeting, Trump's sit-down with China's Xi Jinping. It'll be the first time Trump and Xi have met in 6 years. Trump has said he plans to speak with Xi about a range of issues, including Russia's war in Ukraine and possibly Taiwan. But the main focus of the meeting is the escalating trade war between the two countries. Trump, ever the deal maker, has been teasing that the meeting will be a breakthrough.
So I think we're going to end up having a fantastic deal with China. It's going to be a great trade deal. It's going to be fantastic for both countries. And it's going to be fantastic for the entire world.
But experts say they aren't expecting the meeting to move the needle on U.S.-China trade relations. Dennis Wilder is a former intelligence official who's worked for both Democratic and Republican presidents. He now teaches at Georgetown University.
This will be a chance to air their grievances with each other, to make some tactical shifts, to reassure markets, to reassure the world that we're not going to the precipice, but we're not ready for true de-escalation yet.
Wilder says while there won't be a full decrease in tensions at the end of the meeting, he expects some major issues will be addressed, like China's recent move to restrict rare earths exports. The U.S. and many other countries rely on rare earth minerals because they're critical parts of military equipment and other technologies. The move was seen as Xi going on offense in the trade war, and it surprised Trump, who said he might cancel his meeting with Xi. But last week, Trump said the U.S. could retaliate.
They will threaten us with rare earths. I don't think they're threatening us too much right now, but they could do that. But I threaten them with something I think is much more powerful, and that's tariffs.
And in the meantime, economic uncertainty for Americans has loomed. China's boycott on U.S. soybeans has decimated farmers. And overall, tariffs typically result in increased costs for consumers. The instability is negatively impacting Trump. Recent polling shows approval ratings for Trump's handling of the economy are at the lowest they've been in both of Trump's terms. But despite the president's insistence on making a deal with Xi, the outcome of the meeting might just be both countries buying more time. That's according to Ryan Haas, the director of the China Center at Brookings.
I'm not sure that, that either side is prepared to fully climb down from the positions that they've staked out. More so, I expect that the two leaders will get together and announce an extension of the trade truce that has carried over through the summer to limit tariff escalation.
A true trade deal will likely come at a different meeting, like if Trump visited Beijing or Xi came to Washington, says Dennis Wilder. He says this meeting in Korea isn't going to be the place.
It's on the sidelines of a major event with lots of other countries involved. The host is the Koreans. The Chinese are not in control, and the Chinese love control.
But a Beijing meeting may come soon. Trump said he plans to visit China in early 2026. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock tonight, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Cloudy tonight, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40, and tomorrow mostly cloudy with highs 47 to 51. Lows tomorrow night in the low to mid 30s, and for Thursday, cloudy, highs in the upper 40s. Answer our question of the week. Tell us about your favorite Halloween costumes. Text us 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been 100 years, but the Vatican is now expected to return Indigenous artifacts to Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Indigenous communities are preparing for the return of the sacred items.
The museum in the Vatican City has held the artifacts since 1925, but in a few weeks, an announcement is expected that we'll see the return of dozens of artifacts that could be back in Canada by the end of the year. Indigenous communities have been calling on the Catholic Church for decades to return them. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak, has described the artifacts as living, sacred pieces of Indigenous cultures and ceremonies and must be treated as the invaluable objects they are. Cody Grote is an assistant professor of history and Indigenous studies at Western University in Ontario.
To us, these aren't just artifacts that we're going to put behind a glass case. These are ancestors in their own right. They have their own sentience, their own being. So when we repatriate these cultural items, we have to recognize that there's ceremony associated with that. This can't just be a transfer from one box to another to an institution. These are ancestors who need to be welcomed back with ceremony and cultural protocol.
Grote says it's not exactly clear what artifacts are held by the Vatican, but an exhibit at the Vatican in 1925 also published a catalog of specific artifacts, and that's a starting point, he says, to find out what else might be in the collection. Grote also says the artifacts are expected to be transferred to the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, and that the Canadian Museum of History is expected to act as an intermediary. He also says it's important that in all points of the process, First Nations need to be part of the discussions, as he's sure there will be challenges, since the process is expected to be long and slow, but also one that is long overdue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The play Blue Jay's Canoe About Loss, Resilience, and the Power of Native Stories opens next month. Brian Bull, senior reporter for Buffalo's Fire, has this preview.
The story centers around Blue Jay, a DJ at a fictional tribal radio station in Oregon's Willamette Valley.
And good afternoon, and a good day it is indeed.
Kirby Brown plays Blue Jay, who informs and entertains his listeners through the COVID-19 pandemic and the 2020 wildfires. But Blue Jay also struggles.
One of Blue Jay's tragic flaws is that he just doesn't ask for help. When the stuff starts hitting the fan, that's when we gotta hold each other tight.
The big mystery in the play surrounds an incomplete wooden canoe Blue Jay has in storage. The reason why it's been left undone unearths a past tragedy, which has given Blue Jay survivor's guilt. Marta Lou Clifford and Teresa May co-wrote Blue Jay's Canoe. Both have specific lessons they'd like the audience to leave with.
I want them to leave with the importance of stories, the importance of family, and how they are all connected.
Indigenous stories are not artifacts. They're not myths from some time past. They carry knowledge for the present.
The storyline also weaves in traditional teachings and legends, told through a spirit person named Heron, who will eventually be key to solving the show's mystery.
Did you ever hear a story that saved your life?
Blue Jay's Canoe runs through November 23rd at the Very Little Theater in Eugene. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, and Vice Chair U.S. Senator Brian Schatz are hosting a hearing Wednesday on the impacts of the federal government shutdown and tribes. Witnesses are leaders from national Native organizations, including in areas of health and education. The hearing in Washington will also be streamed online. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Israel's military launched a series of airstrikes in Gaza today, killing at least 9 people and injuring several more, according to emergency response teams. This comes after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of violating the U.S. brokered ceasefire. NPR's Rob Schmitz is in Tel Aviv and joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, let's start with the Israeli strikes that have been going on this evening in Gaza. What's the latest now?
Yeah, there are reports of several Israeli airstrikes throughout Gaza tonight. A spokesman for Gaza's civil defense, Mahmoud Bassel, says many of the strikes have targeted civilian neighborhoods. And Basel is saying here that one strike hit a residential building in Gaza City, leaving many floors leveled. So far, he says at least 4 people have been confirmed killed, several others injured in that strike, with more victims likely buried under the rubble. Other strikes hit near Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, in southern Gaza, in the city of Khan Yunis. Another Israeli airstrike hit a vehicle, killing at least 5 people, according to Gaza's civil defense. This death toll will likely change as rescue crews in Gaza try to locate bodies under the rubble of buildings that were hit.
All right. Well, Netanyahu said that these strikes were in retaliation for Hamas violating the ceasefire. How did Hamas break the ceasefire, at least according to Netanyahu?
Yeah, you know, before I get into this, I think it's important to mention here that both sides have accused the other of breaking the ceasefire several times in the past couple of weeks since it was signed. Mm-hmm. You know, this time around, though, Israel said that earlier today, Hamas opened fire and shot a rocket-propelled grenade at Israeli troops who were conducting engineering operations near Rafah in southern Gaza, in Israeli-held territory. Hamas denies taking part of that attack. Now, Israel said the other violation of the ceasefire happened last night when Hamas handed over body parts that Israel said were the partial remains of a hostage who was recovered earlier in the war. Netanyahu called the return of these body parts a clear violation of that ceasefire agreement. And that agreement requires Hamas to return the remaining deceased hostages in Gaza as soon as possible. Hamas responded today by saying that Israel is seeking to fabricate false pretexts to attack Gaza.
Wait, how many bodies of hostages are still left in Gaza as of now? And why exactly is it taking so long to get them out?
So there are still 13 bodies of hostages remaining in Gaza. And as to why it's taking so long, it depends on who you talk to. You know, Hamas says it's struggling to locate the bodies because 2 years of Israeli airstrikes have reduced much of Gaza to rubble, making it difficult to recover them. Israel's government accuses Hamas of lying about this, saying Hamas knows where several of them are located and is purposely delaying their return. This past weekend, Egypt sent a search and rescue team and heavy equipment to help search for the bodies. And Hamas said today it had recovered another body of a hostage, but after Israel announced the plans to strike Gaza, Hamas said in a statement it would delay the handover.
Okay, so what has the White House said about today's strikes?
So Vice President J.D. Vance downplayed the events today, saying that it appeared to be a skirmish and said it does not threaten the ceasefire. Throughout the past 2 weeks, though, as I've mentioned, both sides have blamed each other for violating the ceasefire, yet each maintains their commitments to that ceasefire, and each time that something like this happens, the media has been fond of saying, well, the latest episode threatens a ceasefire. And, you know, the meaning of a ceasefire is to stop shooting at each other. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen today, that is simply not happening. What's clear is that this ceasefire was, from the start, a fragile one, and it is getting more so by the day.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thanks, Elsa.
The Trump administration is studying another big change to some commonly used vaccines. It is considering removing aluminum. The effort is raising new worries among many public health experts. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has the story.
For almost a century, some important vaccines have contained tiny amounts of aluminum.
Aluminum is added to some vaccines because it's a very safe but also effective stimulant of the immune system.
Dr. Jesse Goodman is a vaccine expert at Georgetown University. He used to regulate vaccines at the Food and Drug Administration, but left the agency in 2014.
It's like making your immunity muscle stronger. It basically stimulates your cells to make more antibodies and a stronger immune response overall.
To help protect against diseases like whooping cough, tetanus, the flu. But Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has long questioned the safety of aluminum in vaccines. President Trump recently called for removing aluminum, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now studying doing just that. Some researchers think that's a good idea.
My opinion is something along the lines of what Trump said.
Christopher Exley is a biologist who recently retired from Keele University in the UK. He's long questioned the safety of aluminum in vaccines.
I really believe that aluminum in vaccines is inherently bad, full stop. And so any suggestion that we're going to remove it, I think, is absolutely marvelous, not only for making America healthy again, but for making the world healthy again. Because this has been a mistake. It's been a mistake for over 100 years.
Exley says studies have linked aluminum to health problems, including autism, ADHD, and asthma. But most health experts say those studies are flawed, and there's no good evidence aluminum is unsafe. In fact, a very large, highly regarded Danish study recently debunked any danger even more. Anders Vid at the Statens Serum Institute in Denmark conducted that study, which involved more than 1.2 million Danish children.
We do not see any evidence that aluminum is a cause of serious illness in childhood. There is no scientific reason to take aluminum out of childhood vaccines. There's no science that supports that it's dangerous.
And Vid and other medical experts say removing aluminum from vaccines would cause lots of problems. First of all, the vaccines that contain aluminum just wouldn't work.
To remove aluminum, in effect destroying or limiting the effectiveness of vaccines, is incredibly stupid.
Dr. Stanley Plotkin is a prominent vaccine scientist from the University of Pennsylvania. He notes people are exposed to far more aluminum in the environment than from vaccines, and it would take years to develop new vaccines without aluminum.
And what has happened with measles will happen with other diseases, that is, coming back to this country. So do we want that? Well, apparently some people do.
Now, no one says they want any diseases to come back, but Dr. Ofer Levy at Harvard says vaccine technology has advanced a lot in 100 years.
It's human nature to try to make things even better, right? So with all of the sophisticated science we have in the year 2025, probably there's room for improvement.
So careful research to explore possible alternatives would be a good idea. But even Levy stresses that any changes should only be made if well-conducted studies support it. In the meantime, Levy and others say, no one should hesitate about getting a vaccine containing aluminum. Rob Stein, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the return of their espresso porter filled with roasted coffee flavor, now on tap and in cans throughout the region. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Tune in tomorrow for Public Radio Music Day. We'll have musical green cheese from noon to 1 with Malachi Coons and myself, and events at Bridget's Pub in Bemidji where you can guess that groove and judge that jam at Clacko Brewing in Grand Rapids. Both of those events from 6 to 8. In Bemidji, you can play a fun musical game, and in Grand Rapids, listen to some new music and let us know what you think. And it's Member Appreciation Week. You can find more at kaxc.org. We want to say thank you so much to our members for supporting independent public radio in northern Minnesota.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, a surprising announcement about the ownership of Indian Motorcycle. Then, how a national retailer is making it easier at the checkout line for some living with a disability. And a city in northeastern Minnesota celebrates public safety improvement. I'm Gracie J. Polaris is spinning off its Indian Motorcycle brand into a standalone company. The Minnesota-based manufacturer announced it will sell a majority stake in Indian Motorcycle to Carrollwood LP, a Los Angeles private equity firm. The deal is expected to close early next year and boost Polaris's annual earnings by about $50 million. Polaris CEO says the move will let both companies focus on their strengths and drive innovation. The company says the plant in Monticello, between the Twin Cities and St. Cloud, will continue manufacturing the popular motorcycle for now. In today's main story, people who are blind or have low vision have historically been unable to access self-checkout lines at retail stores. One national retailer is attempting to change that. Lydia Moran has more.
Self-checkout experiences are not fully accessible in most of the country so far that we're aware of today. And Target is changing that.
Steve Decker is a senior manager of digital accessibility at Target. He led the development of new technology that will help people who are blind or have low vision use Target's self-checkout line. It will be in stores nationwide this winter.
We wanted one really seamless, easy experience.
To the side of self-checkout touchscreens, there will soon be a controller with high-contrast tactile buttons and braille labels. Customers can plug in their own wired headphones to activate a screen reader.
Thanks for shopping with us. You save $0.17 today.
It tells me what I've scanned, what the totals are, what items have been added to my cart, but privately through the headphones. That's a key thing to emphasize is the privacy.
Things like ATMs, food service, and airport kiosks have similar accessibility functions for blind and low vision users, but Target says they will be the first to offer this service in mass retail.
I think it's a good thing that they're doing this, especially as self-checkout becomes more and more common.
Aaron Priest is editor of the American Foundation for the Blind's Access World magazine, focused on the intersection of disability and technology. He says people who are blind or have low vision often shop using delivery apps or the help of another person. But as artificial intelligence is increasing the accuracy of computer vision technologies, that's changing.
It's more possible than ever to actually go and just shop on your own and find what you're looking for at a reasonable rate. So this is probably a good time to have accessible checkouts.
Target Steve Decker says the blind community was instrumental in the self-checkout's design. Target brought a kiosk to a National Federation for the Blind convention, where hundreds of people got to test it out.
And that was really important because many blind and low vision people have never been able to use a self-checkout, and they don't get, like I, don't get the opportunity to see other people using the self-checkout to know how it works.
The team is continuing to improve the technology based on feedback they've received from users.
Takes a little bit of practice. I think that's true for anybody, whether they're blind or sighted.
But overall, Steve says people were really excited.
We do hope this will push the rest of the industry of mass retail to know that this is possible. This is something that can be done. And it's something that we are hoping others will follow our lead on.
For North Star Stories, I'm Lydia Moran.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Virginia, Minnesota, in the northeastern part of the state, has a new 50,000 square foot public safety facility. It features upgraded technology, a new training space, and living quarters. Plus, it also brings together the city's fire, police, ambulance, and urban search and rescue under one roof. The city combined funds from the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board with money from the state and federal government to pay for the project. A future solar array is also part of the plan to help power the new building.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles, where spider season is in full swing. And not just because it's almost Halloween, but also because this is the time of year that certain spiders have fattened up, reached adulthood, and are ready to mate.
So wait, Lisa, are we going to see some spider sex tonight at Golden Hour?
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
It's really cool. Spider mating is very interesting.
This is Lisa Gonzalez of the Natural History Museum of LA County, and she's invited me up to this park in the hills of Northeast LA to hike around and meet some spiders for myself.
Oh my God, I love that the back of your car has a bumper sticker that says, "This car is full of spiders."
I mean, sometimes it's true.
And tonight it is true, because Lisa has a little friend waiting in the back of her SUV, a tarantula named Taco.
It's perfect. It's L.A. Taco. It's perfect. She's an L.A. spider.
She's an L.A. spider. So this is a type of tarantula that is found here in L.A. County.
I think of tarantulas as the warm and fuzzy spiders. At least I'm hoping.
They're like little kittens. Okay. Just with eight legs and fangs.
Okay. Let's just hope this one is a kitten, because I will be honest, spiders gross me out. All those legs, they're so creepy crawly, and I hate accidentally walking through their sticky webs. But Lisa is here to change my mind, something she aims to do all the time at the museum, where she is the program manager of the Spider Pavilion, an exhibit full of live spiders. One of her goals in life is to convince people to appreciate arachnids by learning more about them.
Because I've really love these spiders, and I know that they are harmless, and I know so many people are so stressed out about them, and I want to take that off their list of things to be stressed out about.
So Lisa beckons me to touch Taco, yes, as in pet a tarantula, step one in addressing my spider aversion, so I gingerly stick out my finger to caress her on the butt.
Oh, yeah. She's so silky.
They are very, very soft. You're doing great.
Am I? She's walking away from my finger.
Taco very politely says she needs some space. So we begin hiking up the trail to look for other spiders, specifically orb weavers, the ones that spin those fancy circular webs.
So I know that you wanted to meet right before sunset as dusk was setting in. Besides the potentially spooky vibes, why is that such a great time of day to hunt for spiders?
Well, most spiders, not all, but most spiders are more active at night, and they're catching things that are flying around at night.
Gotcha.
So this is a great time to look for spiders as they are building their new webs.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them will rebuild their web every day or even every other day.
Oh my gosh.
They are workers.
Yes.
Imagine having to rebuild your entire house every day.
No.
We pause at the top of a hill, right at a lake, where Lisa says the hunting for orb weavers is good. She knows all the good places because she has been obsessed with spiders since she was a little girl.
In fact, I get more passionate, enthusiastic as I get older.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the less an animal is like people, the more curious I am about them. But in particular, these orb-weaving spiders. These are animals that have no wings.
Right.
And yet are exclusively catching these fast-flying insects that are flying around on this planet, which I just find to be incredible, right?
Right.
It's just mind-blowing to me.
Through evolution, it's managed to be able to build an architecture, a tool, the web, to catch these flying prey.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically able to access this whole a buffet that's going on in the air.
At this point, it's getting dark, so we switch on our flashlights and begin to patrol the lake's edge.
A bat just flew over, so we can look for some bats, too, while we're looking for spiders.
That's
why
cool.
not?
Why
right?
not? It's Halloween.
It's Halloween time. Let's do it.
We're walking slowly, scanning with our flashlights.
Look at this spooky tree. See? This would be perfect.
Yeah.
If I was a spider, I would live here.
We're searching for some shimmer of silk against the night sky.
Oh my God, there's one right in front of us. It looks bright white under your flashlight.
Then, all of a sudden, we start seeing webs everywhere.
Oh, yeah, look at that one. My guess would be this is her last night on that web, and then she'll probably break it down. And when they actually consume their old webs to recycle the protein,
they will eat their homes.
Yes.
And recycle
some of those nutrients to produce more silk. That's, you know, precious protein.
Totally. Also noted, you use the pronoun she. So only female spiders are the web builders among orb weavers.
So the males can produce silk.
Okay.
But these particular spiders that we're seeing, the females are the ones that are much larger and making these really large webs. Mm-hmm. And the males are really just focused on mating.
God, this is such a parallel. And woman's so, taking care of the work.
Yeah. So, and I'm hoping we'll be able to find some of the males, but they're so much smaller than the females, they can be hard to spot.
And then, high up in a tree, we do spot what could be a teeny tiny little man spider lurking at the edge of a big web, poised to approach the plump female sitting at the center.
Yes. Okay, so that might
Is
be
that a
male. Yeah. Oh, look it. She definitely responded to him coming out on the web.
Wait, like in a get off my property, get off my lawn?
It very seemed like get off my lawn. But that does look like it's a small male that is trying his best to convince her that he should be able to like come down there and mate with her.
Yeah.
And then other times, if the female catches something and is eating, then the males will take the opportunity to come down and attempt to mate with her, because if she's occupied with eating on something, she's less likely to eat him. And
he will interrupt her meal.
She can multitask, so she'll keep eating.
The male backs away. Sorry, you tried, but sometimes a female just isn't in the mood, okay? But seriously, I had no idea this gender dynamic transferred over to arachnids. And after learning all of this about just how industrious and innovative spiders are, you know what? I have become a true believer. I asked Lisa to make the case for spiders for those non-believers out there.
Well, they do so many different things. I mean, one, they're eating insects, so they're helping as a natural form of pest management.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also a part of the food web. There are other animals that eat spiders, too.
That's an important function.
Absolutely. Spiders are really interesting because they're some of the first animals to repopulate areas that are regenerating after, you know, maybe there was a fire that came through, or the trees were cut for some reason, and then we're trying to reestablish that natural area. When spiders are really little, when they're babies, they release silk that allows them to balloon or fly away from where they were born. So they're some of the first animals that will start to repopulate areas. So they're really important indicator for restoration ecologists when they're coming in to see how, you know, things are growing and getting better.
They're like the earliest signs of promise in a area that you want to resuscitate or revive. If you see spiders there, that's a good sign.
Yes, they're a sign of hope.
They are a sign of hope. I really like that. I feel like when I proceed with my life after parting ways with you tonight, I'm going to be extra careful about not walking through webs, about making sure I definitely never kill spiders from now on. I might not have the same promise with flies and mosquitoes or ants, but spiders will have a special honor in my world, okay?
That's a great start. That's a great start.
That was Lisa Gonzalez, program manager of the Natural History Museum of LA County's Spider Pavilion, helping us all learn to love spiders this Halloween.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Cloudy tonight, chance of rain, lows 32 to 40, and tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs 47 to 51. For Thursday, cloudy with highs in the upper.